See, according to this, you're already dead. Get out of here, baby.
Welcome back to episode 3 of Chopping It Up. This week we're looking at the haunting 1990 vehicle Jacob's Ladder and comparing it to 2019's Daniel Isn't Real. Once again, I'm your host, Jesse Goodman, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Joel Reeves and Michael Sled. And as a special guest, we give it up for the world's best and most handsome producer, Jay, who is doing the yeoman's work on the show and keeps us moving forward. He's actually going to join us today as an extra co-host. Thank you for your service, Jay. Let's get to it.
Yay.
First impressions and thoughts. Let's go ahead and go around the horn here, and everyone can give me their first impressions on this. I'm going to go ahead and kick it off. Jay will hit you second, Sled third, and Joel, you'll bring up the rear, which I'm sure you're used to. All right. I'll go ahead and say out front, I guess I'll count it as not having seen either movie. I believe I saw Jacob's Ladder so many years ago when I was like a 15, I can't recall it. And when I began rewatching it, I guess I didn't recall anything other than that he was a Vietnam vet. For Daniel Isn't Real was absolutely my first time seeing that. So I'll start off with Daniel Isn't Real. Super slow. The whole subgenre that we're kind of going to be exploring this week, which we have, deemed psychological horror, is something I'm not familiar with. It's not really my wheelhouse. So it dragged for me first 45 minutes, 50 minutes before I could start really getting into it. And I understood what was happening, by three quarters of the way through and for the end. It just never really got me. I was pretty underwhelmed with it. I can see the through lines for Jacob's Ladder. I rewatched Jacob's Ladder. Really, really good. Really, really good. An absolute who's who with people in it. Really super disturbing and super depressing. But it's a quality movie. It's not one that I would rewatch, not because it's not any good, but because it is. Man, it takes something out of you. Jay, what'd you think?
Yeah, I hadn't seen Jacob's Ladder in a super long time. It was definitely a first for Daniel, like this go around when we ended up picking it to compare Jacob's Ladder to. We sort of had picked Jacob's Ladder first. I'll say for Daniel, I had the opposite sort of, the part that I liked better was kind of like the first half, the first hour. And then the second half, I think, we were talking about a little bit before we kicked off the recording, but just like the second half of the movie, I think, is like very indicative of the differences in which they and how they make movies today and like what they're trying to do, where the second half is just like, let's give, the Daniel character like more of like a backstory, and it has to have like a little bit of a universe and make sense that way. And then, kind of turns into like a superhero action ending tilt at the end, so it kind of actually like loses the psychological, it becomes like a sort of a different movie in the second half, and even though it's clearly like a cut below Jacob, several cuts below Jacob's Ladder, I think if they'd sort of kept the tone and sort of like of the first part of the movie, it could have been far, far better than it ended up being. Yeah. Jacob's Ladder is just like amazing. Every time, it's like the craft and love that screenwriter Ruben and Adrian Lyne like put into this and like crafting every scene, like the symbolism laden throughout the movie. And it was really like one of the first of the subgenre to do this thing and influence so many of the movies, the psychological horror movies that followed, probably, even including Daniel Isn't Real in many ways, as we'll probably talk about, just cultural broadly, video games, everything. And, it's just such a gut punch of a movie, as you say. And, the ending of the movie is, like, so perfect and just something that seems like you'd never get away with in how they make movies today. So, yeah, absolutely love Jacob's Ladder.
Awesome. Sled, what do you got?
Yeah, so I had seen Jacob's Ladder literally probably more than 100 times. But also, I had not seen Daniel Isn't Real until this. And so
I will say it doesn't surprise me that you've seen Jacob's Ladder hundreds of times.
Yeah, I have a tendency to watch certain movies over and over and over again if I really like, if I like them and I feel like there's stuff that I see in them that I didn't see before. And as Jay mentioned, Jacob's Ladder has, there's so much symbolism. It's almost, it's unrealistic even really to go into it, to think that we could talk about the stuff. It's almost like you could go scene by scene dissecting things that happen throughout it that like have deeper meanings or like attached to something else. And so that's part of what I really liked. It's also an interesting movie. I didn't see it when it first came out. So I saw it later on when I was, first time I was probably like 16 or 17. And the thing that struck me, one was, it was, the movie was so much different than how it was marketed from what I recall. What I recall it being marketed, it was marketed as a very like straight up kind of like horror movie, right? And in some ways, it's almost not a horror movie at all. Like it has a lot of disturbing imagery in it and stuff like that. But then at the end, I actually love the end. I don't find it draining at all. It's super uplifting and positive to me. Like it's like very happy. It's touching. But yeah, so I can watch it over and over again. For Daniel Isn't Real, similar to Jay, I liked the beginning. Somewhat, I could see the attachments, connections with Jacob's Ladder in particular. One particular scene where he goes into the dance and he first kind of has his first freak out and falls on the ground and all the people are looking over him. That's very obviously supposed to be similar to the scene in Jacob's Ladder where he falls on the ground at the party and has a similar kind of vibe going on. Although it's the effects in Jacob's Ladder are much more, tend to be more quick cut and not like making it so extreme. Like, whereas the monsters that are looking down on him in Daniel Isn't Real are very like, kind of like over the top looking, I guess you'd say. And you really get a good look at him. It's like, oh, like this is weird. And also obviously he's his son. So that's part of the connection. That, and then the subway, they show that they have a subway kind of setting a lot. So I liked it starting off because to me, it felt like originally it was kind of going in this thing where it's like, okay, this is kind of just a set, like his alter ego. Like it's like a real psychological kind of issue. Like he has almost like a split personality thing going on. And then it kind of goes into this thing where they're wavering back and forth between it, which is fine. But then at the end for the last half, they kind of just decide to go with like, oh, he's definitely a monster. And like Jay said, go totally kind of like off the rails, like with like, we got to make something happen and make this exciting so that people will want to like come away from it. And they just like, it just got really just out there, like over the top, like they're fighting with the swords in his imagination on the top of the building at the end. And then, he like jumps off and I guess it was supposed to be a broomstick the whole time. I don't know. But so, I was not impressed, I guess, would be my overall take of that.
Got it. Joel, what do you think?
All right. So first point, it is very hard to go last in this whole rundown, because I had a really hard time not going, yeah, I agree, right, like the whole time. So I'll start with Daniel Isn't Real. So a lot of this is going to be echoing things you guys have said. I'll just say briefly, I didn't particularly care for it. I didn't hate it. I don't think it's any of the actors' fault. I think everyone as an actor did a good job. I thought they all did well. I believe it's Patrick Schwarzenegger, Arnold's kid. It was a standout in it, right? Like he does a good job as that. I think it's a screenplay problem. And I think it's because the movie starts out very much like you were saying, Michael, and you alluded to as well, Jay, very much psychological horror, that it's some sort of schizophrenic episode, right? But it loses its nerve or whatever, changes its mind and becomes a jumbled mess. Because halfway on, they're like, I'm going to staple Sinister or Babadook to the back of this movie. And it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? It's not terrible, but it's not particularly good. It's largely forgettable, right? Other than I think Patrick Schwarzenegger has a pretty good performance, which is why he's gotten a lot of work out of it. Jacob's Ladder, I think, is probably about as good as this genre can be for me. Alternatively, right, like the Daniel isn't real. I love all the symbolism stuff. We'll get into that deeply. I'm sure we all have notes. I read the screenplay, like I was saying. Like, it was a lot of fun. It's very, very good. Tim Robbins is great in it. Yeah, and there are notable actors scattered all through this thing. And I think you started to talk about this, Jay, but like, this has been so influential up to and including, like, the Silent Hill video games and movies, you know, and, like, all of that. Like, I've got a little bit of background on how they did some of the special effects. So, yeah, I mean, Jacob's Ladder, can't say enough positive things. Even though this is not exactly my genre that I really like, it's about as good as it's going to get out of this genre. So,
got it.
That's my thoughts.
Appreciate it, guys. Well, let's go ahead and move right on into the next segment here. We got Joel's movie stats, where for you new listeners, Joel's going to provide background information. You know, significant actors, directors, producers. We're talking about, you know, the domestic, international, gross, everything that that each film did respectively. Joel, I know you've read up on this, so let's hear it. Go for it.
So, yeah, I've actually probably read entirely too much of this at this point, so I'll have a hard time getting it all out of my head. But I'll just start with Jacob's Ladder, 1990 release,
okay.
Which I had forgotten it was that long ago. I mean, I hate thinking 1990 is that long ago, but it is like 34 years ago.
It's funny because when I remembered, when I was thinking about Jacob's Ladder, I thought it was like 85, 80. I thought it was in the mid-80s.
I was kind of back and forth. I was like, well, it can't be that long ago. But then the imagery I remembered being very old. I don't know. I couldn't figure out where I was. The director was Adrian Lin. He was director of, let's see, I've got a bunch of them. Fatal Attraction, Indecent Proposal, the 1987 Jeremy Irons version of Lolita, Flashdance. So like
9.5 weeks.
A lot of stuff. What's that?
9.5 weeks.
Yeah, 9.5 weeks. Really, so that. One of the things I think is interesting about that is, honestly, I mean, 9.5 weeks, a little less so, but like, they're all kind of sexy movies, right? And this has a lot of, like, I mean, weirdly erotic stuff.
Are we gonna? I mean, I'm down to do like a 40-minute diversionary discussion on Elizabeth Pena. I'm sure everyone is down.
I will put it this way because I'm trying to keep things polite in case my kids listen to this. Right. She was formative in my youth, right? Like, that's all I'll say.
Slide, what'd you say?
Jacob says he's describing in the movie, he's describing her to his actual wife.
Eight
thighs.
He's
not wrong. He's not wrong.
No, she's amazing. By the way, 9.5 weeks is also an extremely sexy. Maybe
it is. It okay? I haven't seen it.
If anything, it's the most over the top sexy of all of them,
isn't it? From what I recall,
okay. So Adrian, this is all in his.
This is like very his lane, the sexy part. So the writer was Bruce Joel Rubin. He was the writer of Ghost as well. That's what he's most famous for, other than this. And this was like a big passion project of his. So we'll get into that a bunch. And then
Ghost came out the same year as Jacob's Ladder, too. So that was like quite a year.
Yeah, it was a big, big year for him. Also, we'll get into this later. Uncredited, obviously, we all know this because we just watched it recently. Macaulay Culkin, same year as Home Alone, right? So the original Home Alone came out the same year as Jacob's Ladder.
Wild.
Yeah. So, anyways, and then the cinematographer is Jeffrey Kimball. So, getting into some of the basics, you've got a runtime of nearly 2 hours. My version was an hour and 53 minutes. Had a budget of about $25 million. Gross domestically about 26. So, it did not do particularly well.
Which is crazy considering the absolute who's who of like people in it.
Yeah,
to be continued. So
yeah,
I mean, I think a lot of that's just because it is. It's a weird movie. So when I first watched it,
very weird.
It was one of the first movies I mean, as a young person, one of the first movies I'd seen that didn't have a linear story. Not only didn't have a linear story, but had things going on that seemed to contradict each other as far as what was happening and stuff. Like he's moving
very
like,
consciously too. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was intentional. And so, I mean, definitely my first time I watched it as a teenager, my main take was like, what the fuck just happened? Like, yeah.
Which is honestly at 47, I had a bit of what the fuck just happened.
Yeah. So, I think that probably impacted it. Cause I think from what I remember reading, it did really well its first week and then it dropped off. So, I mean,
it's like 35% from first week to second week. And then another 35% each sequential week. Right. And so
my word of mouth a lot was like, oh, it's just fucking weird. Like it's like people didn't know what was going on. And so I'm guessing that impacted
also
it.
For your average opinion
of movies.
It's also, I think what you said earlier, which was, it was marketed as a horror movie, as a very stereotypical horror movie. So you drew in the horror crowd and they're like, you know, yo, this is not like, what I signed up for. And apparently, I don't know if Joel, this is on your list of stuff, but Bruce Joel Rubin tried really hard to get them to change the marketing to not go horror.
Yep.
And apparently somewhere along the marketing run, they started backing away from it a little bit or not emphasizing it so much. But I do think that was like another of the reasons. But it was probably never going to, I mean, it's just too weird.
I think it's also just like, if we look at it as it's a fairly, even though it's a big budget, I mean, $25 million back in 1990 was a lot of money. It's a fairly odd film to try and make a big budget film. Now, one could argue they kind of needed to, because you need all those squibs, you need all those explosions. That scene in the beginning that we're going to talk about with the war, that was not cheap. Right? Yeah. Like in all of the subsequent, just renting a helicopter. I cannot imagine how much it costs to rent a helicopter, but it is not cheap. Right? So like all those things added up. So it may just be simply a budgetary problem. Right?
Yeah.
So I'll just give you a couple of the major folks. Then we can talk about them as we go on that show up as actors in this. So you've obviously got Tim Robbins and Miss Pena, as we were saying. But you've got Ving Rhames, Danny Aiello, the late great Danny Aiello. So I didn't know this guy's name, but I've seen him in 100 things. It's the guy who plays Paul. His name is like Purity. I don't even know.
Pruitt Taylor Vince.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Pruitt Taylor Vince. He's an Identity. He's in Angel Heart, which was another movie we considered for this, and Constantine, which I thought was an interesting one.
And Identity Alexander is another psychological, is very similar.
Yeah, Identity. We considered both.
I won't have much to offer for this podcast, again, as it's out of my wheelhouse, but I do want to point out that you are omitting clearly the biggest actor in the bunch. Eric LaSalle, also known as Derek from Coming to America, who was the son of the Soul Glow inventor.
I did not, in my first pass of the cast, I did not catch that. I do have a gem in there. I don't know if you guys saw. But yeah, when I realized that, I was like, that's Soul Glow guy.
Yeah.
It took me a minute, but yeah. Kyle Bass of Tenacious D is buried in this movie as well.
Kyle Bass.
He's one of the guys helping him when he's getting the ice bath, right?
Like, yeah, I think that's him in the tub. Yeah,
it's kind of tricky to see because that scene is hopping all over the place.
Mm-hmm. All right, mine I don't even know if really happened. There were so many names that popped up in the movie as far as actors that I couldn't like chase them all down. So during the palm reading scene at the party, the young lady who walks down the stairs as Tim Robbins is walking up the stairs to eventually interact with the palm reader, she walks down the stairs. She's a young black woman. She looks like Jaleesa from A Different World, who I don't know the actress's name.
I didn't.
So check. The same time frame.
But the lady who is the palm reader is in like
Yeah, I've seen her in a bunch of stuff.
Cop shows, right? Yeah, she's in like Law and Order.
That's Agatha Murchison. Yeah.
There you go.
The woman when he first goes to the hospital or to go see his psychiatrist.
Yes.
The woman, she's in a ton of stuff as well.
She's she was like a bitch.
Nurse lady who has like a horn in the back.
Yes.
That insane horn thing or whatever.
That's the principal from Uncle Buck
who had that big mole. Have that thing gnawed off your face.
Have that thing. Right. She's always got some shit growing on her head somewhere.
So, my favorite one in there
is she. So Ray Liotta, Henry Hill's wife's.
Oh my god!
Pick up on that either.
Jesus Christ!
So did you guys catch Lewis Black? In this,
the Jacob's doctor. Yeah,
I saw that and I was like, "Well, who hasn't blacked up or blacked out and then woken up and seen Lewis Black?"
Yeah, well, he's unmistakable. You see his face and you're like, "Wait a second."
So that's Jacob's Ladder. Gives you a sense of it. Now, Daniel isn't real.
Wait a minute. You're not going to talk about George Costanza as the lawyer?
I missed that one. But I will say he's doing yeoman's work in this, right? Yeah. Like, he really is chewing up scenery, and it's great.
The one other minor one was the woman who plays Sarah plays the dead mom in Signs.
And she plays the love interest in Fletch 2, Fletch Lives.
That's right.
Get out. That's amazing. Oh, I forgot to do the reception. So the reception of this movie, like I said, was kind of lukewarm. It was weird. People were very split amongst the critics, right? Like, so the critics, I think like the New York Times gave like a 90 out of 100. Like Chicago Tribune was like a 80 out of 100. So it was very high scores. And then you got, like, the Washington Post, their reviewer at the time, and another one, I can't remember, give it, like, a 30 out of 100. Like, it was very split, right? So the over meta score, where they aggregated it all together, was 62, which is pretty low, I think, for this movie. And then the IMDb score, which is, again, made of like, modern users, right, current people, is a 7.4. out of 10, which is almost great for a horror movie. So then shifting over to Daniel Isn't Real. Now, there's not as many gems in terms of the cast in Daniel Isn't Real for obvious reasons. It's mainly because it came out in 2019, right? So years go on, we're going to be like, oh, that's the guy from so-and-so. That's the guy from so-and-so. But I will start with, it came out, like I said, in 2019. The gentleman's name is Adam Egypt Mortimer, I think is how you would say it. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But he did a movie called Some Kind of Hate. That's what he's kind of famous for. And this movie. This is by far his biggest movie yet. He did a few other things. He did another, like, a short compilation called Holidays, which is kind of well known. He was in that. And then the writers of this were him again, Adam Egypt, and then Bryant Delaney, and then Lyle Vincent. This guy is interesting. He's the cinematographer. He worked on a movie called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which is a vampire movie set in modern day Iran. I think it's modern day. By an Iranian director as well. And it's supposed to be really good. I haven't seen it yet. So I don't know if you guys knew this part, but that movie came out through Spectrum Vision, which a founding member of that is Elijah Wood. Right? So what's neat about that is that there are a whole slew of movies that came out that were released by Spectrum Vision. And, like, half of the people that worked on these other movies, like, Jay, I know you love these two.
Yep.
Mandy and... Color Out of Space.
Color Out of Space.
Jesse, I think you just watched Cooties the other day.
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah, they're all out of this production house.
Oh, wow.
Another one is A Girl Walked Home Alone at Night, right? Like, so, again, a lot of these people worked on these other movies that made
people, stars in various ways, and they landed in this one film, kind of pulling things together. That being said, this is kind of an art house movie, so it did not make a lot of money. It did well in that I think it was meant to promote these people, right? Yeah. So they would advance their careers, but it only made like $75,000, okay. Which, again,
which
it's
is
a very
like $68,000 more than it should have. But yeah, all right, we'll go into that.
I think
a little bit.
I think it also was maybe released like straight like video on like to streaming services.
It's very few
right
screen.
After the
right, yeah, yeah, the, exactly,
the,
yeah,
the,
yeah.
Southwest Circuit or whatever. So.
Right. Yep, yeah, no, that's exactly right. And honestly, the pandemic did not help. But even without the pandemic, this is not a broad release movie, right? Like it just would not have been that kind of thing. So made about $75K. I forgot to say it's about an hour and 40 minutes long, at least the version I watched. It got a, what I think is a surprisingly high Metascore. I got a 61, so right at the same level as Jacob's Ladder. But again, some of that I actually attribute to what Jay was saying, which is the, hey, it's kind of got a happy ending-ish thing to it, right? In that there's a heroic, you know, movement in it.
I think another reason
is much more difficult.
We'll talk about it later, I assume, when we like dive into like cultural significance and whatever, but I think another reason it got a lot of kudos from critics is it's like kind of like very in your face with some, let's call it like not exactly social justice, but like sort of like woke themes in some sense of toxic masculinity and you know those kinds of things. And I think critics ate that up because it's mentioned all over the place in the reviews.
I think that's true, and I think it was a little less so, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, which is when Jacob's Ladder's audience would have been. So
sorry,
go ahead, Jess.
Sorry to jump in, Joel, but unless you had anything else, we can go ahead and segue right into, I think, the cultural significant cinematic significance.
I think it's a good transition.
All right. let's jump in. I want to say before we really start getting into it, and this of course is the meat of the show. And I said this to Jazz when we were chatting earlier. It's interesting because the first two episodes, the first four movies have been entirely outward facing to society, to the world, to the, you know, everything. These two films, this episode is entirely inward facing, and it explores the interior lives of its characters to like a terrifying result and degree. Again, it's really out of my wheelhouse, but so I'm not sure where to go with the cultural significance, although I'm sure we can get there. I'm sure you guys have a lot of thoughts. I guess we can go ahead, Jay, if you want to lead off on this, I'll gladly bring up the rear. We go Jay, Sled, Joel, and then I'll go after that.
Yeah, sure. So one thing about Jacob's Ladder that I think is like interesting to mention as well, which sort of is almost like facts or stats in some way, is this was like a big run of Vietnam movies or using like Vietnam to sort of like talk about society. So like just around the time this came out, you know, 1986, Platoon, 1987, Hamburger Hill, 1987, Full Metal Jacket, 1989, Born on the 4th of July. And this is not a Vietnam movie like per se, but, you know, clearly, you know, it's like a major influence or a major part of like what's going on.
Yeah, it's used as a device.
Yeah. And, you know, and so I think like that is also just sort of like part of the context of like still grappling with Vietnam, or like these are when the movies were coming out where like America was sort of like grappling with Vietnam in some significant sense.
Jazz, sorry, but I guess I'll get into this when I go last, but no, I would absolutely categorize it as a Vietnam movie. I wouldn't call it psychological horror. In fact, I don't think the subgenre exists, which I can also get into, but anyways, we'll get back to that. But yeah, I have a major issue with that.
Yeah. I guess it's not like it doesn't say so much about like Vietnam so much as like the effect of, you know, Vietnam on these people, or like, I don't know, trust of government with like sort of like experimenting on soldiers and all that kind of stuff. I think it's less Vietnam centric than the others for sure, even Born on the 4th of July.
The others are much more over. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So it's kind of funny because I actually see the Vietnam aspect is really not even part of it. It's almost just a tool for explore. Like it's just a plot device to explore the what's happening to this person between while they're dying, basically. And like and what it's, you know, or different and different maybe planes of existence or realities that could be out there and are existing. I mean, it is there, but it's like it's actually probably my least favorite part of it is the Vietnam aspect and the also the latter aspect. Like, I hate that. Like, at the end of the movie when they're like the blah 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 government experimented with this drug.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah.
I would actually agree with you that I think
try and like add that into like the at the end, just get rid of it.
Well, I think the part of it. So, I would say like the screenwriter, like Bruce Joel Rubin, would probably agree with you on that. Like, he did not intend to like write a Vietnam movie. And I don't know why, and in the screenplay, there's like various, and Joel, I don't know if he'll get into this when we talk about screenplay parts, but, the opening of the movie in the screenplay, the Vietnam, sequence, like kind of like gives away the whole plot of the movie. Mystery from the screenplay of like what's going on in Jacob's head. You know what I mean? It's much more like a rumination on like.
I do actually think that's better without the twist. Personally.
On the this sort of like what's going on between life and death and like what goes on in people. That's kind of like was Bruce Joel Rubin's intent. I think the way in which they made the movie, you know, the way it was filmed ultimately, like was actually far. You know, the Vietnam stuff was there. You know, the weird stinger at the end with like, you know, let's talk about this government thing for some reason, which was also weird, but clearly like. It was made, you know, the whole thing was made more Vietnam centric, I think, as it was filmed as a result. So,
yeah, I just don't think you can separate that stuff out. I mean, it's hand in glove. All of the distrust of government figures, all of the trauma endured, all of that stuff. Like Sled, you were like, they just used it as a vehicle to get at this psychological stuff. You have a hard time using something else. They used it because it's integral to the movie. I mean, I really think on its face, that movie, the whole thing is about Vietnam. Like many years ago, there was a movie that came out with Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez and Kathy Bates. It was called The War at Home. Mm-hmm. And Emilio Estevez is a young Vietnam vet, comes home for the holidays, and he's completely fucked up. There's like, I can't recall, it's been so many years, but there's either like one or two scenes totaling like 6 minutes of the entire runtime of the movie that are actually in Vietnam. The rest of it is like in the fucking living room of his suburban house fighting with his parents about how fucked up he is. And it's, of course, you know, back in the days when they had video stores, it was on the shelf under like the fucking Vietnam War movie thing, as it should have been. And as this should have been. Like, the idea of saying this is a quote psychological horror movie to me is tantamount to being like, okay, horror movies are like tacos, okay? And like, oh, but there's like different kinds of tacos, right? There's beef tacos, there's pork, there's chicken, there's fish, and then also on that shelf over there, there's broccoli tacos. No, that's not a taco. You just stuff broccoli inside of a fucking wrap. That's what psychological horror is.
You never had a veggie taco?
I just don't think this movie is examining Vietnam very much compared to like a lot of those other movies.
And right, yeah, but it doesn't Vietnam have to. It's exploring the effects it had psychologically on the person. It's still Vietnam.
I agree. I'm saying it's less of that than those other movies. And if in the screenplay, I think it's even less actually.
Okay. Yeah,
and the screenplay was really just sort of like let's really just get into exploring what's going on in this person's mind.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Jim.
No, shoot.
So the thing that I was going to say is I think what you guys are highlighting is the tension between Ruben and Lynn. So Lynn is the director, very consciously, and they had pretty heated arguments about cutting out a lot of scenes that made the...
I'll say the Ruben, the way he wrote, and you tell me if you disagree, Jack, but the way he wrote the screenplay was there are two major traumatic events that happen in Jacob's life. One is the death of his son, Gabe, which causes him to basically leave his life and go to Vietnam, where he again then experiences a traumatic event, which is the war, and then is eventually killed. And we live out him letting go of that trauma so he can go on and move on, you know, with whatever happens next. Ruben was trying to write about really that last three words I said, right? Like the whatever comes next. And that's what the screenplay is really about.
Agreed.
I think Lynn spent a lot of time in the middle, which was that there's this traumatic event. And I don't mean like just the war. I mean like also the imagery of what hell was, right? Hell was that world in New York City where he was with Jesse, right? Jezebel. And there was a lot of real heavy emphasis in that world and the war, and a lot less discussion about the what moves you from the earth to whatever, right? Like,
hey, what did you guys get? Not to go too far away from that, but it just reminded me that New York has a sort of character in both movies and how the city was portrayed differently from Daniel Isn't Real to Jacob's Ladder. Did you guys?
Oh, really interesting.
Like, I don't, I mean, look, growing up as a fucking 80s kid, like, everything New York City was taught to me through movies. It's like, so I thought it was like something entirely different than what it was. But the movie, the city in 1990 via Jacob's Ladder is the grimiest fuck. Like, how much of that was them trying to create the hellscape that he had inside his mind versus like what New York City was like in 88 and 89?
It was definitely New York City was. The movies captured the gentrification and cleanup of New York City as well. You could say that for sure. Like it's far less of a character in Daniel Isn't Real. And if you, I read a couple of the interviews with the filmakers, and like so it's actually based on a book. They got co-writer wrote a book and they adapted it to the movie. And they were gonna in the book it takes place in Manhattan.
Okay, I have the name here. It's I just didn't get to it.
Something like
This Is the Way I Was Saved.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And that apparently takes place in Manhattan. And then they were going to like film the whole thing in Philadelphia. And then at the last minute, it became like Brooklyn. And like Jacob's Ladder, like he lives in Brooklyn in the movie. And yeah, the gentrification cleanup is like pretty dramatic. Yeah. You know,
I mean, there's a reference to like reference to Greenpoint maybe, which was used to be a predominantly very working class Polish neighborhood. Which is now, you can't get a fucking apartment.
Real posh, right?
It's just north of Williamsburg, and is like trust fund kids, and but yeah, I mean, even from like the very opening, you know. So if you take like in Jacob's Ladder, like there's a Vietnam sequence. He gets stabbed in the gut by the bayonet. Boom! Wakes up on the dirtiest subway in the history of humankind. He looks up, you know, he's reading The Stranger by Albert, you know, Camus, very over your beach over the head symbolism a little bit.
Yeah, that was definitely heavy handed.
Yeah, it's in the screenplay too. But
yeah, no, it is. You're right. Yeah.
And what's not in the screenplay, or what's changed from the screenplay, are the two posters he sees immediately as he looks up. One, it was it was like New York, maybe a crazy town, but you'll never die of boredom.
Jazz, just to stop you for a second, because I don't want to just skim past that, the Camus thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the character Mersal, who sort of stumbles through life, right? Things happen to him. He witnesses a murder. He commits murder during the fight that his friend was involved in. But the idea, I remember just taking that away from like, you know, some lit class somewhere, Jazz, was like the transformation of Mersal. Did he change was like the essay question. And the idea was that, which I completely fucked up, right? I was like, no, he was fucking the same guy. And my professor was like, no, you're an idiot. Like it went from the passive acceptance of the meaninglessness to the world and the bad, the slings and arrows that life throws your way, to his fundamental change to the active embrace of that. And I think the embrace, the same embrace that Jacob ends up doing at the end, is letting it all go and holding on to what is meaningful to him. Yeah. And the active embrace of that is what eventually brings him to the peaceful state.
It's been a long time since I've... Sorry, go ahead. You go first, Joel.
I would just say this. And Jay, I would, again, chime in if you think I'm off on anything. That what you just said, Jesse, I think Ruben would be very pleased with the fact that that's what you got from the movie. Right? Because yeah. I think that's what he was going for. I think Lynn kind of, I mean, like I've read and probably everybody else did a couple things on Lynn. There was an interesting article on the movie from Fangoria that you can read that talks a little bit about it. But I think there was an absolute like intent to make more of a statement around MK Ultra and like mm-hmm. Vietnam from Lynn. Like, I just think he wanted to do that. Yeah, so he made things a little more of her.
That's what he did prepping for it, was just watching a ton of Vietnam movies and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he made things a little more overt. Like, everything was a little bit, which is amazing to me. Like, because, again, two of us have at least looked over the screenplay pretty good. I don't think they added any Vietnam scenes. Like, I think they were all in there, but they were just much more, they were longer for one. I feel like that the first scene was pretty long.
Very long.
Right. That was a good 10, 15 minutes. And it's like two pages, unless I'm wrong in the script, right? Like, it's very quick.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that you came away with that's the whole point of the ladder, right? Like, and I could talk a little bit later if we want about the actual Jacob's ladder from Genesis that they're alluding to, or not even they're referencing. But anyways, Jay, you were going to say something.
Yeah. I mean, I just to add one thing on that before jumping back to the other side, I'd say that, you know, Ruben basically wrote like a philosophical screenplay. Is very much somewhat like a work of philosophy, influenced by a work of philosophy, also influenced by
Jacob like, is a pretty, philosopher, right? Like,
yeah, and influenced by like a pretty crazy, you know, acid trip he had where he ended up dreaming about being trapped in the subway and stuff. So, I think like his intent still comes through, and I think it's great when people pick up on that. But yeah, I think Lynn had, you know, that's why they're at odds a lot during the making of the movie. I was talking about the subway poster just sort of as sort of about like New York City as a character and the differences between the two movies. But, you know, the subway posters that were added different from the screenplay, which were different posters, were, you know, New York may be a crazy town, but you'll never die of boredom. And then hell, that's what life can be, doing drugs. Mm-hmm. And then, so he's on this filthy subway. He immediately sees those. What I love about the subway sequence in general at the beginning, it pretty much sort of like lays out everything that's going on in the whole movie. Like, he wakes up there right after he stabbed. So, you know, he's dying, you know, he's on the train, you know, to some destination. He doesn't know if he's past his destination yet, you know, where it is. He's trying to like talk to this other person on the subway who's just silent in response to everything he says.
That, of course, the silence that she gives him, the stoic look and disposition is the, again, it's like, and I didn't of course get this myself, but from Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson, his father is, unresponsive, wheelchair bound. He had no relationship with him for many years. He finally comes to see him and tries to make peace with him, pours his heart out to his father, apologizes for all the shit he's done in his life. And his dad just like doesn't respond to him at all. And all of that is to say that it represents the indifference of God, right? And so he's lost. Help me. Did I miss my stop? Where am I going? And God just fucking looks right through him. Like, yeah. That's the response.
Whether it's God or another demon or angel, or sure. There's no one there to help him.
Yeah. Or another human.
Another dead
right?
person.
Like, yeah, right.
Exactly. This is one of the things that, you know, Lynn... changed from the screenplay, and I think it's better that it's silent. The person in the screenplay is, I think he has her as, you know, maybe like Puerto Rican or Spanish, like trying to say like,
yeah,
like I don't speak English. She can't speak
English well, but she's not silent. Yeah,
way better change.
Yeah,
and then he, you know, he gets off. He can't sort of escape. There's no way out. You know, and then he has to get like back on the subway tracks. The train's coming, and nearly runs him over again. He manages to just like barely escape. There's all these passengers looking out, and then there's the passenger at the very end with like the faceless person.
Yeah.
Looking at him, who I would argue is him, looking back on the train.
One waves at him.
Yeah, the one that waves at him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so did you notice that right before that, there is there's a lot of ladder imagery, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's simply that, like, it's the rails are going up at an angle, looks a lot like a ladder, and then there's light at the top. Like, it's very. Like, they very purposely put imagery all over the place in this thing. It's just, it's very well directed.
Yeah. So I wanted to separate out a few things here because I'll play the dummy for this because a lot of this stuff still goes over my head. I still can't understand, like, the difference between what's reality and what's dream and what they're right. I feel like I'm being cheated, which is maybe why I refuse to acknowledge this as a subgenre. Like, I feel like they're playing with me and they're saying, like, oh, like, this thing that you're clearly seeing, like, might not have happened, but we're not going to tell you. And that's the only reason why the end of Jacob's Ladder, I was finally like, okay, great. It was all a dream. Because apparently you guys figured out that he was dead or dying, like, in the first 5 minutes of the movie. It took me, like, halfway through the movie.
No. You're saying, like,
we remember watch that it again from...
and then see, like, oh, they are laying it out. But okay. you don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, dude. It took me so long. I thought, I was like, "What the fuck? All these guys figured this shit out."
No.
We did not, or at least I did not.
But at least that ties up everything else because we're like, "Oh, this was dreams that he was having." So anything is fair game. So
and you Jesse,
that saves it for me. But for Daniel, isn't real. I don't know if any of this happened or didn't happen or so these are two different parts of his personality, or he's actually a monster or whatever the deal is, but like he's in the bathroom passed out, Daniel is, and the razor is there, the straight razor, right? And he takes the razor and holds it to his throat and is going to kill him or whatever. And then wait a second, he didn't touch the, so he didn't, he's passed out. He didn't physically pick up a razor and put it to his own neck, right?
So that's right. One of the, I mean, the rules of the universe in
are
Daniel
very are very
just a jumble.
Well, I fuck that, man.
Yeah. And
my thinking of Daniel isn't real is that they hung a line, but then at the end they just went all the way. It's all real.
That's right.
It's all like,
and that's
like none of it's psychological. This is all this being, and it like it's doing these things, and it's they gave it back. Like Joel mentioned, they gave it backstory. And like it's been around for centuries and blah blah blah.
So Joel, was it the devil? What the fuck? Like what?
So from what I can tell, right? And really, I'm hanging a lot on the scene where, what's his name? The
Luke
is in the dollhouse, right?
And he's
walking and he gets to the trophy room, right? And there's lots of different stuff there, and then he sees. I'll say a Renaissance style painting, right? That it looks like a hell lord eating people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I took it as okay, and I seriously started Googling trying to figure out if that's a real painting, right? I couldn't find anything substantial because there are paintings that look like that.
Jazz wants a whole book of those paintings because he's an absolute fucking sociopath.
Yeah, well, that and everything that Jacob was looking through when he started like diving.
All right. All the Dante ones. Yeah, there's a lot of again, if we're talking about doing it well versus not doing it well, one is Jacob's Ladder. I think is much better watched at least your second time.
Yeah,
right. Like, and I think that's why it didn't do well commercially because people go in and they're like, "What the fuck is that? I don't even know what to tell anyone." Right. Go ahead, Michael.
I was going to say, I think it doesn't matter how many times you watch Jacob's Ladder. You could decide, like, one thing, it's like some older movies where it doesn't try and explain everything to you, so it allows you to actually interpret things how you want.
I think
it
makes it much better.
And I think, yes, it's which is phenomenal. I wish more modern movies did that. But I think the more you can watch it over again, I can make an argument that the only parts of it that are real in our universe are the Vietnam scenes, and that the rest of it, none of it happens.
Yeah, that everything is set in 1971.
Absolutely. Really want to get like metaphysical on it and like existential is that all of it is real.
Yep.
All of it are different lives that he like lived or like maybe another version of did like he experienced. And like, so, I mean, it's very real in the movie, right? It, like so, it's filmed real to him. It's not filmed like it's abstract and something crazy. Like there's nothing right. That doesn't feel real going on. And so I think like, right. And I think there's those two ends and then there's everything in between on how you could decide yeah. Which part of it is real.
And I'll give you the one that drove me nuts in Daniel Isn't Real. Right. Cause I felt myself ebb and flow with that movie where I was like, okay, you got me. I'm back in. Right. So like take the scene where he's with the psychiatrist, which by the way, I wrote his name down. I'm not even going to try and pronounce it, but he was in Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Jesse doesn't watch superhero movies.
He's in Guardians of the Galaxy 3 as the High Evolutionary. I'm not going to try and pronounce his name.
All you're doing is detracting even more meat cleavers from this room. Go ahead. We'll write that.
It lost cool points. Okay.
Chuck Woody Iwuji? I don't know. That's what I'm going to try.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's. I'm sure it sounds great. I'm just not going to be able to get it out. So... anyways, that gentleman, he's the psychiatrist, right? And he's helping, and he's decided to do this ritual with the bowl, and he's going to hypnotize them both and blah, 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 blah. Great. I'm in, right? Like, I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. And then there's a voice in his ear, and he's like, holy shit, that was real. I heard that, right? Like, that, I was in.
Oh, yeah, that's what, I remember
that scene. But then we hop to when his girlfriend, I forget her name, but Sophie's the other girl.
College girl who ends up macing him when she decides he's crazy. Yeah.
So the one who's the artist, and I forget her name.
The manic pixie dream girl, Cassie. Yeah.
Yes.
Cassie.
So Cassie, when Daniel reveals himself and he starts manipulating his face, like, is that happening? I have no idea. Right,
it's the entire Daniel Isn't Real. It's the hypnosis scene where the thing goes completely off the rails. Yeah. It's just like that's when it's just sort of like, what are you doing? Like, what are the rules? It's like you don't have to explain everything, but it's like
you have to be at least consistent.
Either leave it a mystery. Because all of a sudden the guy explain everything, but you can't do this like, oh, yeah.
Thank you. That's right, Sled. Yeah. No, it's a cheat, and that's why I have such an issue with this subgenre, and I don't know how much of it – like, Joel's right. Like, when it's done right, and we're presuming that Jacob's Ladder is maybe the best that could be done in this subgenre, I can get with it. Jacob's Ladder was a very, very, very good movie. I'll never watch it again because it takes something out of you. It's just so fucking sad. But, you know, Daniel Isn't Real breaks all the rules. It manipulates the audience in ways that it shouldn't be able to. And I thought it's all, like, for wrestling parlance, Sled, it's all cheap heat, man. Everything they got was cheap heat, and I'm just not with that.
Yeah, you know, they really just need, you know, we were talking about, like, you know, what is this thing or whatever, and Joel was mentioning the painting. It's like, this is the, why do we need this backstory? Like, why do we need to, like, live in this
house? Or you need to have all the backstory.
Exactly.
Right?
Either
you need to do one or the other. Right?
That's what I'm saying. Explain everything or leave it a mystery. You can't, you know, you're in this house. It's like, okay, so you're like a demon, I guess. And then you target, you know, schizophrenic people, occupy their minds, do what you want to do till you use them up. But then somehow some of your victims also still live in your castle house brain dimension or whatever it is. For some reason, even though they're dead in real life.
Yeah, if they were going to do it, they needed one parlor scene where they're like, oh, and they meet with a, you know, what's his name? Lupus from Professor whatever from Halloween, right? Where they meet with the professor and he's got a doll's eyes and he's the center of evil.
Yeah.
Whatever. And then we're back in business, right? Like,
But you know, it's really just like, they just couldn't decide.
Yeah.
They wanted, you know, in, you watch Jacob's Ladder, you watch it a second time through, and you can say like, ah, here's where they're like laying breadcrumbs. There's the symbolism. There's all these things layered in where you can be
but
like,
it's a watching straight line, time
and enriching the experience. And with Daniel, it's like, it's just random. Everything they do is just like, oh, I think this would make for like a good Instagram reel.
See if you appreciate this. Yeah. See if you appreciate this. George Lucas, I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was George Lucas, was basically saying about an audience, you can do anything you want with your universe as long as it's consistent.
Yeah.
Right? In his universe, spaceships blow up and they make a fireball. Right? When there's no air in space, right? Like, so they wouldn't make a giant explosion. They'd make a little foof as the air inside of the ship was consumed, and that would be that, right? So anyways, his point was that, like, you know, if you don't make it consistent, then people will call you out immediately. And that's, to me, what Daniel
does. Yeah, it ruined it. Ruined it for me. But before we, I mean, I am going to bury it anyway, but I did want
to
point out
there's still
things.
Plenty to talk about with Jacob's Ladder if we want to,
we can double back.
No, but I just meant, I didn't mean bury it, like, move on. I meant, like, bury it, like, talk shit about it. There were a few things that I did want to point out, is like, which at least evinced to me that there was effort put into it. I just don't think it worked because of the inconsistencies that you guys just talked about. But so there was the sort of did you guys ever read The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman? Do you remember that? Yes, you might remember that. Okay, yeah. Person's Descent into Madness, right, which parallels this. And they're sleeping in this attic, and there is yellow wallpaper, but she starts peeling at it. She sees something behind it, and there's layers and layers and messages of stuff going on inside the wallpaper. It eventually drives her to madness. There was a sort of through line there at Mary Stuart Masterson, the mother, Daniel's mom, has lined the walls with these newspaper clippings, and he's pulling through and reading stuff. It was very much clearly like an homage to The Yellow Wallpaper. And also just another effort to make a decent flick was when Cassie shatters the bottle, she throws the glass bottle, remember? And Mary Stuart Masterson, the mother, is constantly smashing the silverware and the dishes and everything. And Daniel's drawn to both of them, one because of how he grew up with his mom and that kind of outburst. And so, like, that he found that a little bit in Cassie and was drawn to it, even though it was clearly destructive and unstable. But
yeah, I thought the other thing that, like, if the movie, like, it kept on, like, hinting or playing with things that if it kept on pulling on one particular thread, it could have actually gone somewhere and been interesting. Like how like mental health professionals like don't actually help or actually unleash the thing. If you remember, like, you know, the therapist, you know, Daniel goes to see him. I'm afraid of becoming like my mom, all this kind of stuff. He's like, you know, don't be afraid of your imagination, which by the way, he immediately literally physically runs into Cassie right after that. So I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, possibly she's a figment of she's certainly a manic pixie dream girl, but is she also like a figment of his imagination in some sense? Right. But you know, they could have really pulled on that thread because he's the one that unleashes Daniel. He's the one that then like further unleashes Daniel. You know, there's some things that you could go with there, but no, it's just like a throwaway thing to like get us to like a goddamn superhero fight with the demon. So it's just really like, you know.
Which again, I'm not anti superhero fight with the demon. Like I just talking about Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Like do that if you're going to do it. Just don't have the pretense of being like something else, right? Like so,
do that for the whole movie.
For the whole movie.
Yeah. Don't try to be movie number one for 45 minutes and then decide all of a sudden you know you want to be movie number two for the last 45 minutes. It's just
so
really
there was a trope that I liked, and I feel like I was yanked back and forth. And Michael, I'd be curious what you think of this, but there's this trope called sealed evil in a can, which is basically like the dollhouse, right? They you know get in, they push the evil into the can, right? And then it's that, what's it, the gun that you see in scene one, and now you have
Chekhov's
to see
gun.
It by scene three. Yeah, exactly. So it's that, right? It's that seal evil in a can. It's like Annabelle the doll, right? Like you have to get away. So they had me there right? And I was like, okay, we're going to do that type of movie. That could be something, right? But then they just kind of, they let it out, and then it was like, I can't tell, like, for 30 minutes, I was like, oh, wait, I was wrong. That's just, I read that wrong. It's just schizophrenia, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a demon. It's schizophrenia, right? What did you think about that? I mean, am I nuts, right, for thinking all this stuff?
It's from what perspective?
Well, so I guess what I'm saying is that, like,
I mean, they definitely did that.
Okay. Did everybody else feel is yanked around?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they totally wasted it, honestly. They wasted it almost the whole movie. Like, they could have done something cool with the house, and they didn't until however long in. And by that point, they had screwed it all up with the other 45 minutes of the movie they put between actually getting back to it.
God damn. 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just going ballparking off the top of my head.
No, that sounds about right.
But yeah. I have in my notes here, really drags with the love story. That's like literally what I wrote, right? Like,
yeah.
Which love story? The Cassie?
Cassie, where it's just kind of like, oh, okay, I get.
Why Sled, you wanted the Sophie love story. You wanted this.
Cassie actually, she was actually a great casting. I don't know if it's just that. But she reminded me a lot of a girlfriend that I had that was also kind of a lunatic. But, like, not just in how she acted, but how she looked. So I don't know if that's, you know, but it was a good performance. I don't know. I thought it was a good casting. Actually, you mentioned the psychologist. I don't know if they determined. Was he a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
One or the other. I don't think they said.
I wrote down psychiatrist, so it must be right.
But yeah, I think that he was supposed to be kind of sinister. I mean, he has a sinister way about his acting, like at least like his portrayal of those the characters I've seen him. He's always someone sinister. Guardians of the Galaxy, he was a bad guy, Jesse, pretty creepy.
He didn't emote any sort of empathy, which I don't think was unintentional. It wasn't a knock on his acting. I think maybe you're right that they didn't want.
Well, I think what they could have done with him, which is sort of kind of how he played it, is basically overconfident and smug. Release the imagination. Yeah. Let's do this scene and I'll be able to control it. So they could have done that with mental health.
How flip of him to say
semi-supernatural stuff. Like, he pulls out his little dagger and he's like all into it. Like, I don't know.
All of a sudden it's the dagger of a shaman fucking golden child.
And he's like, I don't go Van Helsing with him. Do something besides what they did.
So is everybody, I think you're going to like this one.
All right.
So.
And then hold on, Joel, after you do this, I do want to move on to the next segment.
Okay.
We still
this will be perfect. This will be the last one I have.
Okay.
So just because he's guest hosting this week and he's on camera, I'm going to reveal these facts now.
Oh no.
Because he's going to blow a gasket. Because he's so on point with his analysis of it being some kind of lame superhero thing. All right. Marvel's fingerprints are all over the cast in this.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
So I'll give you one. One we already talked about, which is and actually, let me say it more clearly. It's not all Marvel. It's superhero. Like, everyone involved in this pretty much ends up in a superhero vehicle. So one. The one guy, like I said, is from Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Cassie, she is in two superhero vehicles. She's in Loki, the series, right? And she does, like, the voice for a podcast one, which is Marvel's Wastelands for Hawkeye. Then you have Patrick Schwarzenegger is in, what's it called?
Gen Z.
And he is Golden Boy. Which is like, you don't need to know anything with that one, Jess, other than he's a major character for the first like few episodes of like he's the major one of the most
boys about 50 times at this point, but he refuses.
What's that?
What'd you say?
To get Jesse to watch the boys multiple times.
The more you tell me superheroes,
it's just sci-fi.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't think that's going to win him over. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Jay, I was hoping that might break you down there, but apparently you're still in good spirits, so I'll have to come up with more depressing shit.
Let's move on that note. On that note, especially since we're discussing the psychiatrist / psychologist, let's move on to the favorite kill or favorite scene segment here.
Yeah.
And I'll lead off on that. Because I think we were 1 hour and 15 minutes into Daniel yep. Isn't Real before anyone dies who's the psychiatrist / psychologist. I guess you could technically count the opening scene where Luke jumps in with the shotgun, but like you never actually see anyone die or anyone even get hit. You don't really know. I would count the psychiatrist, which that scene really wasn't a great kill scene, but there just weren't a lot of kill scenes in that movie, which is why A, it sucked, and B, it's not a horror movie. the favorite kill or favorite scene in Jacob's Ladder for me, I had none down for that because it was so fucking depressing that I had no favorite scene. All of it was absolutely fucking utterly dejecting.
Yeah, you liked it. Yeah, you liked
it. Look, I can't deny what a very good movie it is, but I just don't think. Now, this is, I mean, Sled, you and I got into this, and I'm already outgunned and I still have no definitions. Sled asked me on one of our, to pull back the curtain to the listeners here, we're on a text chain, and Sled asked me, and I was bitching about the subgenre, and Sled said, what's your definition of horror then? And I just like avoided it. And I was like, you know what? I'll come up with some cutesy shit later and I'll pop it on him on the podcast. And I have nothing. I don't know. It's sort of like, what's the Supreme Court decision where they're like, I don't know what porn is, but I know it when I see it. Like, I know a horror movie when I see it. This ain't that. There's gore in it. Sure. There were some scenes that were very discomforting. But that doesn't really get it for me. Like, there's something else going on there, like that would constitute horror for me. Anyway, sorry to take us so far askance, but Sled, you want to do your favorite kill or favorite scene?
So I kind of go the reverse. So I don't think I have any favorite scenes from Daniel Isn't Real. I mean,
fair enough. Fair enough. I won't force you into that.
I'm trying to think of what scenes Jacob's Ladder. You know, there's a cup. So, I mean, probably from a horror movie scene, probably the best scene is, I mean, the one that people are going to think of is the one where he's going through the hospital. Yeah. He's getting rolled on the knee. Like, it's just so, like, and it's, you know, it starts out relatively whatever, and then it just, like, and it's supposed to be, and it's a descent, right? Like, it's increasingly getting worse and worse. It starts out, it just kind of run down, and then you've got, like, broken glass, and then he's, like, and
these
it's
are,
all...
These are, It's Dante's Inferno. They're all the spheres of hell.
It's an alternate title for the movie, apparently, in real life. And if you read, I read something where Ruben was talking about his script idea for it, and he's like, Jay mentioned it earlier, like it was based on a dream he had, and he's saying, you know, a subway late at night, I'm traveling through the bowels of New York City, there are very few people on the train. A terrible loneliness grips me. The train pulls into the station and I get off. The platform is deserted. I walk to the nearest exit and discover the gate is locked. A feeling of terrible despair begins to pulse through me as I hike to the other end of the platform. To my horror, that exit is chained too. I am totally trapped and overwhelmed by a sense of doom. I know with perfect certainty that I will never see daylight again. My only hope is to jump onto the tracks and enter the tunnel, the darkness. The only direction from there is down. I know the next stop on my journey is hell. Partly that came out of my own fear and despair because nothing in my life seemed to be working. In Illinois, I felt like my story had evaporated completely. My story was, you don't have a story. Here you are living in a cornfield, no friends, no work. Your wife is supporting the family. Basically, in my mind, the story is over. I could have given up my filmmaking goals and settled into a different kind of lifestyle. My story could have been, okay, you tried. Instead, I woke up from my subway dream and said, that's a great opening for a movie. And then I tried to write my way out of hell. And so it's kind of like that's like the whole move. Like that scene's so great. Like he's descending like into hell and they do a really good job of like, you're like, wow, this looks fucking awful. So that's a great scene. But another, I love the scene at the end. I know you keep saying the movie's depressing. I still think it's uplifting. I mean, it's sad because his son is dead, right. But he's like, that's his son's waiting for him there at the bottom of what is Jacob's ladder. You know, you get into Genesis and it's, you know, Genesis 28. Well, he had a dream in which he saw a stairway
resting on the earth, which is top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And I don't know how familiar you are with the Bible, but Gabriel, Gabe, is the angel of death in the Bible. Like, he escorts souls. So it's like, again, getting just into the symbology of the movie, there's so much stuff layered into it with all the different things. But those two.
I think my perspective is different because I'm an atheist, nihilist, communist Jew. So when he's like, oh yeah, I give up, and then I'm going to walk into heaven with my kid, I'm like, oh, so he's dead. Like that for me, but is he, like, oh, he's dead. So
even in that reading, right, which I think is a legitimate reading, right? Like, oh,
which
reading? Dead, right?
What, which
reading?
Oh,
your reading. Like, I think Michael's is the intended reading, and which is more where I end up. But even with your reading, Jesse, I think you can still go, well, but he died happy, right? Like, because he's going off with his son, right? Like, so it's not, I am saying that as someone who was depressed as shit after watching this, because I have a son named Gabe. And, like, it was really hard watching
that. Like, you watch that scene. Oh, that actually is a kind of an underscored scene or understated scene is when Gabe gets hit by the car.
Yeah. Oh, or I would see the bike in the
house. That's what I was going to say, Joel.
Like, the way they do it, and, like, Macaulay Culkin, he's probably, like, 15 or something when they film this. So he looks like he's, like, 6, you know, in this
movie. Yeah.
It's very well done.
Yeah. But like you still like it's all in your imagination, and it's just like, oh, like it's just like you feel it in your guts. Like,
I think if I watched it 100 times, I'd have 100 different readings, and I think that's where Michael ends up. So,
all right, thank you, Sled. I'll do Jazz and then Joel. But I did want to say I'll go back because you reminded me, Sled, with the. I mean, it's clear that you love Jacob's Ladder, and you could probably name 10 of your favorite scenes there, which is fair. I did not name a favorite scene. I was stuck on the favorite kill, which I didn't have one. But I do want to say my favorite scene, if I can just bring down all of the intellectualism in this podcast for a moment.
I know where this is going, but go ahead.
Was the scene where you first get introduced to Elizabeth Pena. They're in the apartment, and she's sort of like – he's like lying in bed. He wakes up, and she's just like – her shirt's half undone, her tits are hanging out, she's smoking a cigarette, and she's just, god damn, she looks sexy. And I'm, you know what, that's my favorite scene. That's what I'm going with.
That's fair.
Nothing wrong with that.
That's not, can't argue.
Carmen from Down Out in Beverly Hills.
That's another movie where it was formative. That's what I'm going to say.
Oh, are you kidding me?
There's a reading of it in which it's a horror movie, I'm sure we are.
You can definitely get an excuse to watch that movie. Yeah.
Oh man! All right, Jazz, go for it.
So I'll do the one from Daniel. And there again, it's slim pickings, as everyone says. And I'll say, like, it's the favorite scene and it's the most disappointing scene because I think it's sort of when the movie really could have gone one way and done something, you know, real and decent. And it's sort of like from that point it starts diverging. Is when his mom, you know, finally has her, you know, psychological break at the house, when his mom had a psychological break at the house. You know, like he has released Daniel, you know, all this turmoil in his life, he's, you know, released Daniel again. We don't know which way, you know, it's going to go. Daniel actually like helps him. Even though, you know, the past with the mom is sort of sinister there because he tried to offer. And, you know, it was at that point, it's like the movie really could have turned into, you know, a different kind of movie. Like that was like a solid point from which to continue building like a good movie before all the weird stuff they, you know, they sort of ended up doing. And I thought it was just, you know, generally like pretty well done, at least from like Mary Stuart Masterson and stuff, you know, deep cut from 80s actresses there. Nice to see her. So, you know, I'll say that one. And then for Jacob's Ladder, like, it, you know, I think the three seminal scenes, in a sense, you could pick from are, you know, the subway, the hospital, and then the party. And
they're all great.
I'll advocate for the party on my part, just because you read about like how they filmed it and like all the, like the crazy creature effects and stuff that they did, and Adrian Lin just showing like what a master he is, like. He said a lot of them just didn't, they look too fake, they look too this, that. And he's like, I only wanted to do, he like shows like 5 seconds of like a creature kind of thing here and there. Like just enough for you yourself to be like, is he seeing this? You know, nothing's in your face. Nothing's over the top. Did he drink too much? Is he tired? You know, and it's just like little hints of things, little, you know, the beginnings of realizing he's in
much
more hell or whether it's purgatory, but all these demons who are just leaving this sort of like hedonistic sort of thing and just trying to keep him trapped on this plane for whatever reason they're doing it, feeding off him. I don't know. You know, it's just so well done with just little hints of stuff. Without being like over the top with anything, and
you can see the imitations of that
everywhere.
Everywhere, but specifically what jumped to my mind, which is where in Jacob's Ladder it's perfectly done, like you're saying, but in this movie, in Devil's Advocate, it's completely over the top. Yeah. The demons, the faces that Keanu Reeves sees, demons are, it's the same principle, but it's way over the top.
And everything that they did with the with like the makeup and everything in Jacob's Ladder, it's like, you know, apparently, you know, Ruben really wanted like very biblical demon imagery, like horns and the whole nine yards. And Lynn is like, that's going to look stupid.
Yeah, that was all Lynn. Switching it like, to the creepier stuff.
Like little hints, like the nurse, when her little nurse thing falls off her head and you, there's that weird,
so disturbing,
tumorous, whatever the thing is, and you're like, what is happening here?
A sebaceous wound or whatever.
Yeah, maybe it's a horn, right? Because it's raised.
I was reading this. The cinematographer, I guess, was heavily influenced by Francis Bacon,
who's
a painter. And like his, I pulled up some of his, you're talking about creepy paintings. Yeah, like his Pope paintings in particular. I'm looking at those. Like,
so the other artist that's mentioned is someone named Joel Peter Witkin, who I'd never heard of before. But Lynn mentions him being an influence on like the kinds of things he wanted to go for. You want to not sleep tonight? Go Google him and see what kind of images come up. It's some really messed up, weird shit.
So before you leave Jacob's Ladder, Jay, I wanted to say this for the special effects, because I think you will appreciate this. The thing that Silent Hill is probably the more recent, although that's still a long time ago, where they're doing the rapid shaking, you know, jerky head movement thing. That is all shot live, right? Yeah. That's all that. So what they're doing is they're shooting at a different frame rate and then speeding it up. Right. And I read about how they did that and they just played with it. It like didn't cost anything. And it is absurdly effective.
Very effective. It's
so off-putting.
Adrian, I was, I don't know if I read this one or watched one of the interviews for some of the deleted scenes where he talks about there's literally no post-production special effects on this movie at all. Zero.
That's amazing.
Everything that they did was shot live.
They just did things in camera.
Yeah.
No use post-production effects.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But I don't know, just to finish up on the party scene, the complete disorientation, strobe lights, like the escalating, you know, hedonism and everything from Jezebel was just like so amazingly done. It's all in how I feel at parties. So, you know,
have any of you seen like the extended cuts of this movie?
I watched the deleted scenes.
And I would actually say they're good deleted scenes. Sometimes you watch extended cuts of movies and then it's like, oh, like this could have been better. Like Zack Snyder's DC movie for
Justice League. Yeah, I hate to say it, but you're right.
Guys, I don't want to interrupt, but
this movie actually
Sled, hold on one sec. I was checking off. And that is, you've actually, everyone's reached their maximum for a comic book movie references. So, I'm sorry. We can't fit anymore.
So what Jay was saying about the understated and like, and how the way the effects work, if you watch the uncut scenes, a lot of them do incorporate more of like the over top, overt, like monster stuff. And they detract from the actual, they make it less creepy. I feel like if you
Michael, what's interesting is the screenplay is the same way. Like the scenes that are cut out are much more like on the nose, with the exception of Jay. You probably remember this one, the one where they have Jacob has the long meeting with his former professor, and he just talks about like everything is just, he's overtly talking about the ladder, and you're a philosopher, and you'll figure that. Everything is too on the nose. And so it's like every edit Lynn did was, in my opinion, perfect.
right? Like they're all great.
I won't talk. Maybe we'll talk about it later. I just want to. I'll say there's one thing that was cut, which I think would have made it better. But we can talk about it at a later point. It has to do with the chemist.
Okay. I would like to hear that.
Joel, favorite scene, favorite kill, anything?
Okay. Yeah. So I have. I'll come back to Jacob's Ladder. I'll start with Daniel Isn't Real. This is how quick I kind of, looking back on it, this is how quick I feel like the movie started to go in the wrong direction. It's actually, my favorite scene was the scene with the young boy, Luke, where he...
Jay, can you isolate that real quick, that line?
Yeah, don't say that.
For Joel.
Say it that way.
Jay, that's going to be the intro for the next show.
Oh boy.
NSA is already listening. That's already on
the screen. Oh, boy. So the actor playing Luke is young, and that scene is good because they're yelling, like, get in to Daniel. And Daniel, I'm trying to be really careful with my words.
Because you're a young man, right?
What's that? Jesus Christ. Stop. Can we edit this out?
You fucking asshole. You have ruined it.
Anyways, the scene where young Luke is talking to his mother, and his mother is convincing him to put Daniel in the dollhouse.
Right.
And she's yelling at him, and then the boy's yelling at Daniel. I was like, this feels like a horror movie, right? That scene felt like a horror movie to me because it was intense. It was a little scary, right? We didn't know exactly what was going on and so on. I think if they had continued with that tone, it could have been really, really interesting. So that's kind of my scene. Please edit a lot of that, Jay.
Right.
I think the scenes actually with the mother, now that you make me think about it, were probably some of the best scenes in it.
Yeah,
I think so. I mean, I know I didn't say a scene for it that I liked, but the scene where he's with her at the actual institution, I thought was a good.
That was good too.
Sitting on the carpet or the bench, talking to each other about whatever, and she got hauled away. But that I can't remember. That was still when they were on the track of this is like a
psychological
mental health thing going on, rather than
I think so.
Yeah,
exactly. And that one was interesting because she like figures out that he's having a problem. And so that could have been an interesting way to go too, right?
Right.
For Jacob's Ladder, it was it was actually several of the scenes with Danny Aiello, right? One, I just like him. I think he's a good actor.
Yeah.
Two, from reading a little bit of Ruben's stuff, it's basically the way he looked at the Jessies versus the Danny Aiellos is that the Jessies of that sphere, whatever you want to call it, are meant to keep you tethered there, right? That's their purpose. And your objective is to break free from those tethers. And the Danny Aiellos are the guides. And what I thought was interesting, they did this multiple times, at least twice. Danny Aiello asked Jacob to roll over. You know, roll over on your left side, and he goes, your other left, or whatever it was, right? Like, he does that at least twice, showing, you know, that he's disoriented, he doesn't know which way he's supposed to go, and blah, 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 and Danny Aiello is there as a guide, right? Like, I thought that was really a cool way to do it. They're casting him with a bright aura. I mean, like, don't get me wrong, all the scenes you guys talked about, are great, and I think Jay's right. The seminal scenes are those big three, but just like a little more subtle one is. I really appreciated those with the chiropractor.
Yeah, the left-right thing was something I made a note of. That it was well done and sort of like the broad disorientation motif that they have going through the whole movie.
And I had some strings on that where I haven't done enough research into it to whether it's. How much thoughtfulness maybe went onto it on the right and left side of the brain and how your body is working and like things are disconnected from your body to your brain now in this state. And so I don't think, but
And then
I wouldn't put that past Lynn. That guy would keep on.
Yeah. No, Sled, you're right. You're right. And also because like at some point I had to make a major adjustment and he like blacks out.
Yeah.
And then he's like, just from the treatment. But I did want to move on to the next section here and discuss this. Our new segment here, which is actually the worst time to implement the new segment for this episode, which is the soundtrack slash musical tracks that we noticed that were of import, that we enjoyed.
I did have one.
All right, go for it.
Okay, it's let me find it. It is Sunny Boy by... let me find it. The singer's name, it's the song that keeps appearing over and over whenever Jake hears or sees Gabe, right? Like he's humming it to Gabe. What's that?
Oh, I know the song. Yeah, I know. It's at the beginning and it's at the very end.
It's at least twice. He's humming it to Gabe, and it is in the car. Like the actual song, and I will find who sings it right as we end this episode, I am sure.
That's right.
That's how it goes. But yeah, so that is one I thought that was
Al Jolson.
God damn it, it's right there. Yep. Thank you for finding it. But yeah, so I thought that was an interesting one.
Sled, did you have anything?
I do actually, and it goes to the movie, the party scene in Jacob's Ladder. So the song that they're playing is what? Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir? So which that maybe means Marmalade. French is, do you want to sleep with me tonight? So, and like, which also is to like make love with me, whatever. But like the insinuations, it's all like what Joel's talking about. There's these certain things in it that are keeping you there. There's like, and so like, I thought that song picked for that particular scene was somewhat intentional at least.
Like, there's another one there, Michael, that I didn't catch first, but then I was like, wait a second. It's James Brown when
that's on my thing. Sideways too, yeah.
The name of the album is Hell.
Oh, so nice.
There's all sorts of stuff like that. Like, I mean, they embedded a lot in that movie, right? Like, so... anyways, it's
thank you.
Really good.
Dang. Jay, you have anything?
You guys hit the ones I would have mentioned. The only other sort of like musical song thing I'll say that I liked from Jacob's Ladder is after the first time he sees Louis, the Danny Aiello character, you know, who he like leaves refreshed, you know, with a spring in his step. He goes outside. There's those girls like on the stoop who see him and start singing to him.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Postman, and it's like, what is the purpose of this scene? And he's all smiling and happy, you know, for a brief moment before the car starts chasing him. And so I was like thinking about it, I was like, you know, is it, given like Louis like the angelic figure, is he also hearing basically like the singing of angels for a brief moment? You know, they're telling him to stay, not, don't go away or something like that. And, you know, right or, after that, you know, he walks away from them and there comes the car.
A more cynical interpretation. Are they like the sirens of Titan? Are they like luring him into the street so he can get killed? By the way, he spends an inordinate amount of time being chased by vehicles in this movie. He's like trains and subways and cars and everything. He's always, it's like, he's like the fucking worst luck ever, this guy.
I think one of those girls, and I haven't looked through the credits to see if I could see her in it. I think it's Pam from Martin.
No, you know what?
One on the left, when you're watching it, she's the one on the left. So she would have been on the right of the person while filming. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Pam from Martin, who also sings with Gina from Martin in Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes, she does. Yeah. Yep.
I saw that and I wasn't sure. So. But if you're mentioning it now, that's both of us. So it probably was her. All right. Unless we have anything else, you guys want to move on? We'll do best lines or quotes.
Oh, man.
I can kick it off if you guys want. It's definitely the palm reader while Jacob's Ladder when Jacob's at the party. and she gets to reading his palm, and she's looking at all the different lines, and she gets to his lifeline, and she's like, according to this, you're already dead. You're out of here, baby. And I'm like, shit, man. Like that, like, even though it affects him in the movie, like, he should have, like, fucking fallen down the stairs backwards. If someone ever said that to me, it would be, that would be right. It for me. Like, I'd lose my mind. I have more if you guys want me to get them, or you want to.
Oh,
go ahead, Joel. Yeah. Yeah, go.
So I enjoyed this. It's, again, with the reading that people like Jesse are meant to keep you tethered to that world. At the point right before she burns all the pictures, which are, by the way, those pictures delivered by Eli, which is the name of one of his other sons. It's Eli and Jed, right?
Right.
And he's like, why can't you remember their names? Blah, blah, blah. Anyways, the thing Jesse says there when he's looking at the picture of Gabe is, I don't like things that make you cry. And fundamentally, he has to deal with the stuff that's making him cry, right? Like, for him to be able to move on. So I thought that was a good one.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, she says that, and then, like, one scene later, she throws all of the pictures down the fucking incinerator. Yeah.
But again, that keeps him from dealing with it.
That's what she's trying to do.
Yeah,
right,
that's
right. Right. Jazz, you got anything?
There's the Danny Aiello, the entire sequence where he talks about Meister Eckhart. That would be, like, the kind of easy one. I did love that in the whole delivery. I'll go a slightly different route, which is like not like necessarily the quote itself that gets me, but just like, again, just like the sparse use of this, the dream on when he's in the hospital bed. And it's like legitimately startling when the way they drop that in at that point. Like, you know, he just has gotten out of like the hospital scene in the basement, you know, where Jezebel's there, he gets stabbed in the head with the needle. Then he's like back in this sort of like fake reality that's sort of like keeping him tethered into place, where it's his family all of a sudden comes in. Sarah's like, you know, I still love you, you know? And then all of a sudden he hears the dream on like come out.
Yeah.
It was just like extremely well done, you know, just like very nicely with the, you know, at this point, the dam is broken. There's no keeping him tethered, and the rest of the movie is just sort of like unraveling that. So,
Sled, you got anything?
I mean, as Jay mentioned, there's the long kind of monologue by Louis, the chiropractor. But no, I don't know if, I mean, and I actually think it's kind of a testament to it as a legit movie, is they didn't write stuff in there necessarily to be a single thing to glom onto. It's something that someone said. It's like everything is all within the context of going it. I mean, there is one interesting thing where the doctor, when he's really getting told, like for the first time getting told by another person, like he's dead, like, you know, he's the doctor says, there is no out of here. You've been killed. Don't you remember? Like, and so like, that's kind of an interest. Like, it's like, I don't know. It's just the whole thing of being in these different worlds and like this stuff is going on, and I don't know, but yeah, I don't know if I have I don't know, there's so much. Even her, like Jezebel, when he's about to leave her for the last time, she's like, please don't leave me or whatever, like please, like she, like
please don't go.
So like so much of the script is written around being intentional of like what they're doing. Like it's, none of it is just like mistake. It's all about like either keeping someone or they're going somewhere or doing something. It's like, it's the amount of intention that goes into that is really impressive. And when you like, it's just so much to even like talk about, like, that's why I can watch it so many times. I think it's because each time I do, I see something and think about it. And it's just like, wow, this is like, oh, like I didn't even think about it in this context.
Yeah. I do think you're right in that it's like not a quotable movie. It's like a mood movie. Like they take so much time and effort and pains to like set the mood and give you this dread. I mean, I actually erred toward like, I had like a handful of like kind of trite quips from, Daniel Isn't Real. So it's just like Mary Stuart Masterson, is like, you gotta love yourself. I remember that was something that stuck out to me. Sophie says, you ever feel like you're hiding your true self, which of course is just like portends you know, what we're going to get down the chute. But that was it for me. You guys have anything else?
No, not for me. I think we got a lot of it at least.
All right. I mean, the most enjoyable lines in some sense from Jacob's Ladder, just in the Vietnam scene, you know, Ving Rhames, choke my black root, you know, the whole,
yeah, all the ball busting. Yeah,
tweezers,
all the
ball, I don't have any stuff. Tweezers like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like classic stuff. I could have done a whole movie of that. It would have been fine with me, with him and Eric LaSalle and all the buddies just busting each other's fucking balls the whole time.
Yeah.
If we're up for being dirty, there is Sophie in Daniel Isn't Real when she said, it's not cheating if it, or no, it's Daniel saying it about Sophie. It's not cheating if it's me. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he fucks her in the whatever that was, like a, I guess the subway.
Yeah, that's not a bad line. Oh wait, there is.
So do we think when Daniel has occupied him and is having sex with Sophie, like whose staying power is he in here? Is this like is he the victim of like whatever Luke?
Actually, you know, that's
body, what, yeah.
What you say there reminds me of what maybe my favorite scene from that, which was already when he's down at the water with them, and Daniel's walking in the water, and he's like, "How's the water feel?" And he says, "Like I wouldn't know, like I don't know, like
right.
he can feel the water," which was like, I don't know, again, felt like a line that could have meant something if they went in a
direction. Missed opportunity, right? Yeah.
All right, let's jump to
power really high because you didn't feel shit. It's like fucking 10 condoms on.
let's jump to our second to last segment here, which is questions. We decided, you know, when you watch any of these movies for these episodes, that you run into philosophical questions, plot or storyline questions, or legitimate questions you want to throw to the rest of the group. So I'll go ahead and lead hit for this. So, I mean, Jacob's Ladder, any of the psychological horror movies, like leave me baffled half the time because I'm simple. But like, so Jesse in Jacob's Ladder, was she a real person who worked at the post office, or he never worked at the post office? He was just a professor.
He never worked.
Okay.
So he has that memory that he had with Sarah when he's lying in bed with her, and he tells her about the dream he's having, and he mentions Jezebel.
And he mentions it. So, yeah, right. Yeah. So if he's talking, and that's real, his wife and him were real.
It's supposed to be after the war, though, isn't it?
What's that, Sled?
When he's back in bed with her, is that supposed to be after the war? Or
no, it's before the war because Gabe is still alive.
Yep.
That's right.
I interpret it as basically like, whatever.
But he was working with an acquaintance at... Name of Jesse at the post office. No,
she said from the post office. I don't know.
Right.
She's If
I think he is working there. They don't get into like the way I read it was that he quit his doctoral.
He did 6 years. Yeah, 6 years, and then only to
and
go.
And then
to...
went to Vietnam.
Right.
After Gabe's death, but I think what you're pointing out is he was probably working at the post office while pursuing his doctorate, and that's where he saw what's her name, Jessica.
Yeah. Okay,
my impression is that she's a real person, at least as far as like there's a person that looks like that with that name.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Yeah, and like all the character, you know, the demons or whatever are, you know, using actual people from his memories to accomplish their ends,
right,
in his mind.
Also, and mine are such just like basic questions. When he had that 106 degree fever and they threw melted 150 pounds of ice on him, it's malaria, right? I mean, he came back from Vietnam. He had malaria.
It's not anything in the sense that he never came back from Vietnam.
Right. But, okay. This is why these movies suck, because I'm asking a question and you're like, well, actually none of it happened because he was dreaming at all. Okay. All right. So then we'll just start the movie where he gets stabbed. Yeah. And we'll end the movie when he fucking, no, it was, look, Look, the reason why I'm asking is because my dad was in Vietnam and got malaria. Mm-hmm. And when he came home, my mom did the same shit. He had like 105 degree fever. Yeah. They were like, your brain is going to melt. And he was in a bathtub full of ice. It was just like that. So like, and then Jesse says to him after it, oh, it's just something, you know, when they can't figure it out, they always say it's a virus.
Right.
Right.
So see, like, I interpreted it just as, you know, within the sort of symbolism that the party made him realize he was sick, or like he became sick with like the knowledge of like what was going on, and the fever was like not a literal fever, but just sort of like representing either him like I don't know letting go or coming to some realization
or overwhelmed
and then them putting him in the which had a lot of like sort of Christ on a cross imagery, the way they're holding him and all that kind of stuff was just more, hey, we have to keep this guy tethered to where we are now, not let him go.
That's how I thought of it.
Yeah. Well, then you're supposed to think, if you do think the background is that he's in a hospital, a field medic hospital, or he's somewhere in Vietnam while that's actually happening, and does he actually just have a super high fever in that world? Cool. From some kind
of... Yeah, could be that as well, yeah.
What's going on?
Again, I don't think any of this is, like, answerable in that the script and the screenplay, like, don't tell us enough information to know for sure. We can just kind of guess around a lot of these things.
All right. I think the purpose that it serves in the screenplay is like after the party, this is what happens. You know, Jezebel is keeping him tethered to where, like, to me, that's the purpose it serves in the story, at least, whatever.
Yeah. Real. That I agree with that.
All right. My last question, and then I'll turn it over to you guys, is do you think Jezzy has an OnlyFans? all right, that's all.
Jesse is gonna love the era of generative AI. Like, it's just gonna be like, he's just gonna be like,
I mean,
make the actress of this Elizabeth Peña circa 1987.
Everything's gonna be circa 1987. Maybe I'm going back to the glory days. Guys, questions. You got it.
Don't forget Predator 2, Jesse. That's what I would say.
Oh, she's also in
there. And La Bamba, that's where I remember first seeing her.
There you go.
Yeah, La Bamba. Yeah, she was on a run.
No real questions from me. I mean, we covered
No questions? The movies are insane. This should be like 40 minutes.
Here's what I would say.
I have no questions.
Oh, I have no questions, Your Honor. I think we've talked about Jacob's Ladder to the point where largely I end up like, okay, everything else, I probably would come up with a different opinion if I watched it again, right? Like, okay. So, which I think is the fun, right? Like, I think that's why the movie is enjoyable. Daniel Isn't Real, I didn't like enough to have a ton of questions, you know, because I think it's so inconsistent, I don't think you can answer it.
There's tons of nitpicks, though. I can nitpick on it all day.
Yeah, but those count. Jess, you sound like you got stuff here. What do you got?
So I'll do Daniel, just since we haven't mentioned that one, and then I definitely have a bunch of stuff from Jacob's Ladder too, though. But the one question I have, again, within the sort of like completely random make it up as you go logic of the movie, there's not going to be answers to these things. But so you could ask, why was he able to banish him as a kid, but not when he was an adult? He like tries to get rid of Daniel as an adult, and he couldn't. I think the explanation would just be like, okay, well now the actual mental illness has started to like take over and affect him. So his mind's not as strong, but then also Daniel's real. So like what, you know, like which pick a lane.
Right.
So
stupid movie. Just fucking
then the
stupid.
Other one to the dollhouse has just been in his room covered with a sheet for like 10 years.
They didn't his mom's a fucking maniac. Like, of course it's still there.
But he also grew up there for, what, he didn't ever consider, like,
Jay,
come on, can we move this to the basement?
Jay, I'm 47 years old. My fucking dollhouse is still at my mom's house, untouched.
But is it in your fucking room? No. Did it stay in your room, like, throughout?
It's still got
like,
my demon in it, right?
He
brought
his, like, you know, his prom date home, and, like, you know, they're going at it, and, like, she's like, what's under that?
Yeah.
I mean, don't
judge. Normal.
I mean, is that one of the things? I mean, I know Jay was talking about how there was a lot of compliments about its woke themes. Was one of did any of it?
Oh, that might. Oh, that
reminded it was for this little boy, the giant fucking dollhouse.
Right, right. Cameroon. I didn't even think. I literally didn't even think of that. That's a great point.
Yes. Well, I mean, didn't have the problem with the dollhouse. You know,
no, it's fucking like, badass. You know, the, yeah, that guy.
Fucking G.I. Joes are just like dollhouses rebranded G.I. Joes, like the fucking forts and whatever. Like whatever.
I will say, I remember Castle Grayskull, yeah. which I had, is pretty much a fucking,
it's a fucking dollhouse. Yeah. Yeah. yeah, you don't want to hear that when you're a little boy. I remember I had like
I don't like thinking it now.
I had this like Wolverine action figure, and we went to India on a trip when I was 7 years old. Yeah. And we went to like, you know, some village that my mom grew up in or around. And the other boys were like, what are you playing with? Oh, it's an action figure. He's like, they're like the doll. I'm like, not doll.
Clarify. Right? Yeah.
Why is there like a past dead victim in Daniel's house and domain? He's dead, but he's like captured there. And it starts off with like this guy chasing him. He's like menacing as shit. Yeah. He's like, you know, this like fucking pinhead or something from.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Daniel gives him the slightest shove, and the guy's like, ah, I'm out. He's on the ground writhing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, Luke pushes in. It's like, so is Luke evil? Like, what's the worst thing this thing was going to do? Give him a hug? You know, he just hasn't seen anybody in a long time.
The only logical answer is this new generation soft, really soft. Yeah,
pretty much. And then I love, like, you know, there's this whole absurd machination of just like he's trapped in there, but then Cassie calls for him from the outside and he manifests like a key in his hand and unlocks the door and opens the door, and then it's just bricks. And he's like, oh no, what am I gonna do? And then Cassie like yells something again and a brick falls out, and Daniel's like, oh great. And he's like, oh, I guess I can remove these bricks if I just push with my hands, you know, just gently. You know, it's very like, you know, it's completely nonsensical.
What it reminded me of is, what is it, Nightmare on Elm Street 4 or 3, where it's like Dream Master.
Four is the Dream Warriors. Is that
Dream Warriors, where the kid is like a wizard and he can, you know, and the one guy had big muscles and like, it's that.
You were like the Mental Health Institute.
Isn't that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And the one chick, Freddy kills her with the needles and.
Yeah, another one. That's free. That seems kind of gross, honestly. It's great. Dude,
that's definitely in our future. Any of the classics.
Gotta do those.
Jazz, you're absolutely killing this segment. Go for it. Keep going.
So Daniel can operate when Luke is unconscious, when he's like passed out in the bathroom.
They didn't clarify that because it would have made sense to me for it to be like, oh, Daniel, so like it could have been a Tyler Durden situation where like he takes over and the Edward Norton character goes to sleep, right? That would make sense, right?
But he's literally the physical body is like collapsed because he's like so drunk, you know, his body can't operate. But like, you know, Daniel then like is able to like get him to like reach and grab the switch, the razor, and like bring it to his neck, which brings up the other questions: like, why does he want to? Does he want to kill him? Like, why does he want to kill him? Are there like other people at the party to occupy? Like, why is he wanting to like nuke his host at that moment? Just like very.
Yeah, we didn't get any sense of the motivation.
Yeah,
because I at one point, like at that point, honestly, round about there, I was like, oh, maybe he's like pissed because he's been trapped in a doll's house for 15 years.
Yeah,
if right he's or whatever, but, right. Yeah. That would make some sense, but he doesn't say, you trapped me.
Yeah. No. I mean, but once he then does occupy him later on, it's not like the first thing he does is like try to off himself. It's just very, it's all very, very strange that way. All right. And then for Jacob's Ladder, they're more, the one thing is like the whole chemist sequence and the ladder, you know, as Sled was saying, is like, that's, you know, kind of like a weak thing. Like it kind of disrupts the, he's all in his head, living his past life kind of stuff. And so there's one thing in a deleted scene where it's much more drawn out thing with the chemist, where the chemist gives him like an antidote to like actually cure the stuff. And it's this whole long, you know, other sequence. But I think what the implication is there is the chemist is also, you know, one of the demons, or like what somebody's trying to tether him to the plane.
That's how I read it.
And then, Newman. But it makes it more explicit in that.
Well, maybe it's something biblical.
Yeah. And then, yeah, that's what I did the new man thing. Yeah, I noted that as well. And then the thing at the another deleted scene at the end, which makes that more clear, is so in the end, like Jezebel confronts him at the house, you know, the house where he ascends the stairs with Gabe. Jezebel's there. It's a much more like she turns into like a more demonic thing and then eventually turns into, you know, Tim Robbins, you know, to Jacob himself. But one of the things she mentions in the screenplay is like, you know, I love your imagination, all these characters you created, you know, the chemist, the ladder, you know, basically implying it's just something that he made up, maybe because he saw a U.S. soldier jabbing him with a bayonet and he couldn't make sense of it or something. Then, so like, yeah, what part was real for, like, absent all these deleted scenes, it just didn't make sense. I had big questions. Yeah. Then the, what did the Santa Claus thing represent to you guys?
Okay, so
yeah,
so
I think it was like
all of this stuff. Oh, like it's like So I took it as like, okay, well, it served just a screenplay purpose also of like half a scene later of him being like, you know, how were you hurt, sir?
Right.
Or where's your identification? Santa Claus took it. Oh, he's fucking nuts. Let's lock him up. Right. Yeah. Like, so it was convenient for that. But I also took it as like, and this is where I think the government stuff kind of, and all the MK Ultra stuff kind of works, is it seems to be that there's two things going on in that sphere. There's the people keeping you tethered, and then there's the elements making things horrible, right? And the government piece, you know, that whole conspiracy basically seemed to be like, oh, you can't trust anybody. We're going to amp your paranoia way up through the roof, right? And then, oh, even Santa Claus mugs you. So, okay, it came off almost a little tongue-in-cheek to me.
For me, I just simplified it, and maybe it was a little easy, but I was just sort of like, that's New York City in the late 80s. That's New York City.
Really,
and they just used New York City as a setting to
70s,
oh, right. Yeah. Well, even better. Even when it's even more fucking chaotic and
rough, right? Yeah.
And rough. Well, that was go ahead. Yeah,
more. Oh, I got yeah. There's one more I had, which was the when he meets Paul and Paul's telling him, you know, he's being, you know, chased by demons and all that stuff. You know, they have their talk, they walk outside the bar. Paul's walking to his car, you know, Daniel finds a dime or a quarter or something on the street, Jacob finds a dime or a quarter or something on the street, bends down to pick it up. Yeah. He's like, my lucky day. He looks over at Paul, who just like has already turned his key and is just like beatifically sort of like smiling at him. And the coin gets sucked away.
That was my
question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that about? Yeah.
It's not your lucky day, or like Paul's the lucky one because he seems peaceful, but like, that's the one I didn't quite feel confident about, like what they were going for with that.
I'm not sure. I would agree with you. That was a little confusing.
Yeah, I have no good answer for that one. I thought the same thing watching it. I thought it was sort of like the universe pulling the quarter away from him, like you said, just to be like a fuck you to you. Like, no, it's not your lucky day. But I don't know.
The one other question I guess I could ask about Jacob's Ladder is after. You know, they go to George Costanza to sort of like, you know, solve their legal problems and get all their answers from the army. Everybody else backs out. And it's like, what's the kind of like reasoning there? Is it just meant to be like, Jacob, you're on your own?
That's what I thought of it as is. Yeah. I wrote down like, it's just another isolating factor, right? Like it's, he's stuck on his own trying to figure this out.
Well, yeah, this is his journey through hell, right? So, you know, Dante has to go it alone, you know, and so does he. Even Eric LaSalle is not going to be there for you. So,
well, and I think it's that much more painful because he almost seemed like he was going to get help.
Right.
And then they yank it out from him.
Well, right. Yeah, just like they yanked the quarter away from him.
That's a good point.
Well, unless anyone else has any more to add, I say we move right on to our patented meat cleaver rating system. I'm going to go ahead and lead off. and give Daniel Isn't Real a merciful one meat cleaver. I'll give it a one. I'm going to give, well, I just thought like, which we touched on maybe in the first episode, Joel, was the three different kinds of artists slash art, which is the creators, the innovators, and the imitators. And for me, Daniel Isn't Real fell squarely in the imitators category, which is like, okay, you've listened to good music or you've seen good movies or you've done whatever and you want to do that, but you can only get there by imitating what you've heard or seen. And that's kind of what we got, you know, like we pointed out some of the similarities there, as much as they could do was an homage, but it didn't, you know, it didn't go anywhere. Way too many inconsistencies for me. The whole subgenre, however they tried to do it, then they make the rules and break the rules. And it was too much. I mean, I give it one meat cleaver. That's probably being generous. And then after you guys made all the ties to all the fucking superhero movies, I wanted to fucking give it a zero cleaver. For Jacob's Ladder, I'll give it a 3.5 meat cleavers. I liked it and respected it for what it was, but it's a hard watch, and I really don't think for me it qualifies as horror. One of these days I'll come up with a working definition for what does qualify, but the gore was there and the unease was there, but for me, let's just leave it as like a psychological thriller, a psychological drama, or just psychological. that's where I went. Sled, what did you think?
I will give Daniel Isn't Real, I'll give it two, because I mean, I've seen stuff that's really bad, and I think I'll save the ones for that. I think it had potential and it kind of squandered it. If it had chosen a direction, whichever way it could have gone, could have been, I think it had a couple different ways it could have gone based on the premise and the way they set it up. And it didn't pick to go either, but tried to like hop back and forth. And it felt like a movie that was written with certain scenes and things happening in mind. It was like playing chess, not thinking any moves ahead. Like, we're going to write like this scene and do this and then do that. And then like, oh, we just did this. Let's do that. What if we did a sword fight on top of the roof? And for no reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give it two, just because I mean, I don't think it's bad enough to get one. Jacob's Ladder, I think I actually agree with you. It's not really a horror movie. I mean, it kind of is. So if I'm going to rate it as a horror movie, I think I would give it 3 or 3.5. But I would give it, me personally, I would give it 5 as a movie. I love the movie.
Yeah.
I think if you're looking for a horror movie, maybe it's not necessarily. I think there's disturbing stuff in it that happens, and there's some imagery and stuff that's obviously really influential, and there's some really creepy things in it. But I don't see it necessarily as a scary movie. I love the movie. I think it's an amazing movie. So I don't know if that's allowed to rate it that way.
I like the way you split that. That works for me.
Yeah.
Jazz, what do you got?
I mean, I think the way Sled split it is probably like pretty much what I would say. I'd say for it, you know, maybe I'm just also just like a sucker for like loving all the symbolism in the movie and like the rewatchability of that element and like trying to figure out, you know, their puzzles. But you know, as a movie, it's like, I don't know, whatever, 4.5, 5, 4.5. As a horror, like 3.5. I think that's very fair. Daniel Isn't Real, it's I'll give it, if we're doing halves, I'll give it 1.5, just because you know, it's there's a lot of like well executed technical elements of it, but mm-hmm. almost like what you expect of movies these days, like very slick in that respect. But it's just like the lack of commitment to like what you're gonna be and like changing it as you go is just like infuriating. Like if you, the infuriating element like reduces the quality even more because you're just like mad at the movie, as you go along. So you know, it's just like so hard, and it's also just like I said, I think it's very much like a difference of movies then and now. You know, they need to like wrap it up with a story about the demon. You know, the demon has a story now, and probably do some shitty sequel with it where they flesh out other backstory with the demon or something like that. And everything is sort of like it's not an auteur thing, as you say. It's very much just a response, lives in response to the critical environment.
Like, what are people going to think about these woke themes? Like, we should include that. And like, some of these special effects scenes are there just so that you can have like a cool thing to post to Instagram, you know, for our trailer or whatever it is. Nothing that really like serves the purpose of the story. And so it's like, part of the reason I hate it is how much it's just sort of captures what so many movies are these days and like how they make their decisions, which is also just like, you know,
yeah,
very, very infuriating. So that's what I'll do.
All right. Joel.
This is why it's hard to go last.
No, this is easy. This is the easy part. Trash Daniel isn't real.
So I'll do Jacob's Ladder first. I would agree with everybody. I think pretty much came out the same way. It's about 3.5. It's a very, very, very good movie. It is eerie at points, but it is never scary. That is why it, at least I don't think it's ever scary. The closest it gets to me is, and maybe creepy a little, but the closest it gets is the party scene. Because it's very disorienting and it's just, you know, so that's why I would knock it, right? Like, it's just not, it's not intense enough with the fear to be a good, you know, or a great horror movie. But as a drama, I think it works really, really well. It's like 4.5.
Yeah.
Daniel Isn't Real is like 1.5. And you know, it's, I would give it even, I would give it higher because I kind of hear what Michael's saying with like, oh, I've seen worse things. That's kind of why I dislike it so much, right? Like, because if it's truly dog shit, yeah. I can at least giggle, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This is more like, oh, someone had some thoughts and then everything was settled by committee and it ended up being a muddled mess. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, we're going to, you know, put this in this stew and then this thing, and then I'll throw some staples in it. And it's like, all of a sudden it's a fucking mess. Sorry. But, yes, yeah, so Daniel Isn't Real isn't very good.
Back around to where it's like a 5 again, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so seriously, like I can watch, Ed Wood's stuff and be like, it is atrocious, but it's funny because he's earnest, right? Like he's trying his hardest. And it's terrible. It's like the Room, right? Like it's great because it is so awful. This is just kind of milquetoast bad, right? Like the worst.
Painfully competent. And not
great. So that's what I would say with it. I to anyone listening, which you know all three of you, I would say save yourself the trouble and go watch like the Babadook or something like that that does this kind of thing. I think they are Sinister, which I think they're trying to do. What's that?
Hereditary. Yeah.
Hereditary.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Hereditary is fucking great. I can't wait until we do that. That's trying to do that sort of thing and does it much, much, much better. So, anyways,
Thank you, sir. And everyone. Thanks for the discussion tonight. Everyone out there, I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. So for everyone out there, thanks again for joining us for our latest effort. I feel like we're starting to hit our stride here. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Please stay tuned for our next episode where we will break down the Sam Neill universe. Joel, calm down. Including Event Horizon in 1997 and one of our favorites on the show, In the Mouth of Madness from 1994. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us an email at choppingituphorrorpod@gmail.com. Again, that's choppingituphorrorpod@gmail.com. We are up on all major streaming platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Linotes, and YouTube. You can also check us out on Instagram at choppingituphorrorpod. Thanks again for listening, folks. And we'll see you next time on Chopping It Up.